changes from various announced programs. So the latest information as of 1:40 this afternoon is as I'm giving to you. I thought we would do, I'll introduce each panel one by one. Particularly some of them are multi-presenter panels. And we'll hold all the questions and conversation until the four panels are finished. And then I ask everyone to come to the front and we can all engage in as much friendly or hostile dialogue as we please. The first panel is social class as a night school theme, and it comes to us from Evergreen State College in Evergreen, Washington. Sarah Ryan, who teaches labor studies at Evergreen, and the two undergraduate students. Joan Hoffmeyer, who works for the Washington State Department of Labor, and Sydney Luff, who's president of the Educational Association Union in her area, Shelton, Washington, which no one on Long Island ever heard of until this afternoon. And without further ado, why don't you tell us about high school in the Evergreen?
Okay. Social class was an organizing theme for a series of courses and what we call programs at Evergreen, that's interdisciplinary inquiry, during the fall and winter and to some degree the spring of this year. The faculty in the program, several of us decided to try to use social class as a central theme and have a group of different classes approach that theme. We had a public health and computer studies program, two writing courses, a sociology course, and the inquiry we're going to talk about today, which was statistics and sociology, a class called Class in the United States, that went over the fall and winter quarters. And then in the spring quarter, we did what we call group learning contracts, where seven of the students who'd been in the program studying statistics and sociology of class came together to learn a little bit more about higher education stratification and working class studies, and to pull all of our statistical analysis into a somewhat cohesive report, which we have with us today. A little bit about the college. Evergreen is a liberal arts college. It's a public school in Olympia, Washington. It has the lowest tuition of any of the state schools in Washington. Its approach to learning is interdisciplinary. Rather than taking a series of courses, students take programs which are interdisciplinary. If they're daytime students, they take a 16-quarter-hour credit full-time program. And the programs often go multiple quarters or all year long. So this one that we're talking about was two quarters. If you want to, we can talk about the roots of that, but the approach goes back to Alexander Michael John and was started in the late 1960s, early 1970s as a critique of the fragmented and competitive practices of higher education, and as a critique of higher education stratification to some degree. Faculty at Evergreen are unranked, so there's no assistant associate, full professor, everyone's just a member of the faculty. And the pay scale is flat in the sense that pay grades are given for experience year only. The poets are paid the same as the business professors. The students, I know, that's very true. Because the idea behind that is you can't have equality within teams if you have gross inequalities of rank and pay between team members in an interdisciplinary practice. In terms of the students, and I'd like to talk about this later, but I may not get to, but the students are not competitive either. There are no grades. People get narrative evaluations. The students evaluate themselves, and it goes in their transcript. They evaluate their faculty, it goes in our permanent record, in a narrative form, not by checking boxes. And it's taken to be an important part of the learning process. There are no requirements. You don't have to take one from column A and one from column B. But the college has enormous strength and depth in environmental studies, natural sciences, to some degree in the humanities, definitely in social sciences, and experimental media. So, a little bit about us. We're not very old. We're only 40 years old. We've always practiced this. But evening and weekend program is a relatively new creation. There was no specific conversation about social class when the program has begun. So some people say that it was only begun to do a full enrollment crisis. So this particular program that I'm going to present some of the data from, Class in the United States, approached the problem of social inequality through mainly through sociology and statistics. My co-faculty on the team was a mathematics faculty, and students learned statistical analysis, used Excel. At the same time, they were learning sociological concepts. And we designed a big survey about social class that everybody was presenting the results for. The survey had over 90 questions, had 531 respondents. If you want to imagine what coding that was like, it was like an exercise in production management. It was really amazing. But the incredibly important thing about having to design a survey when you're trying to learn about class and see if this concept has any legs in your immediate environment is it forces you to reduce theoretical ideas to relatively simple questions, right? And it forces you to make a decision about whose definition of class you're going to work with and how you're going to test and measure those definitions in your own community. So it really, it makes you struggle with the material in a way that talking about it doesn't necessarily. Okay, so what we were looking at was will our analysis look like our authors said it was? Will, we read Black Wealth, White Wealth by Oliver and Shapiro. Will that manifest itself in our data sample? Would we read Working Class Majority by Michael Sutton's White? Were there working class majorities in places in Evergreen? We actually found that there were through our data. So Joan is going to talk a little bit about the data. And Cindy's going to talk a little bit about what we learned. And Joan and Cindy were in the program in the class in the United States, and then both were part of this follow-up group learning contract that worked through the spring to develop our report and presentation. So, show the slides. Yes, and a little bit about what they expected from Evergreen and what they got.
Well, a little what I expected from Evergreen. It was really interesting. Sarah did read out that these schools consider the California woods. Seriously. Tree huggers, you say that. And when I told my children, I have grown children, my 37-year-old son, that I'm going to Evergreen, he said, well, Mom, you're going to take a class in underwater basket weaving. That is the impression that Evergreen gives to the Olympia area. And yet my brother, who has a PhD in education in Eastern Oregon, said that's an excellent choice. It's one of the highest-ranking liberal arts college in the nation. So, you know, you've got two different perspectives, one local, one not.
So I was raised in a college about 20 minutes away, and there's some that well, Evergreen has always been known as the hippie of the tree hugger. So what I expected is a great first day, and by the way, winter quarter is my very first time stepping into college, well, second time stepping into college, so it's been many, many years. And I truly expected to be the oldest person in the class, and everybody there was going to be hippie with dreads and the long gowns, or people with pierced faces and tattoos and cut off of hair and ugly clothes. And when class is done, they're all going to go out and sell marijuana. Fortunately, that was not true. Well, part of it. However, the reason why I chose to go to Evergreen is I work at a middle school, and the teachers, I've worked in social studies for 10 years, and the teachers that come out of Evergreen, graduate from Evergreen, are our top teachers. So last year, a teacher convinced me that I need to go to Evergreen, and
and what I didn't say was there's a class stereotype behind the school, too. Local people believe they're rich East Coast brats because the school has a very high proportion of out-of-state students that that can pay the out-of-state tuition for the college. And the other stereotype we have is a new word, trustafarians. So that's what we were trying to get behind a little bit. And this is my
Thank you. She's a pharmacy tech, and this is the group that worked on the report that we put together. Okay, so.
So we've got some of the charts that we did. We didn't put all of them on here. But this one looks at self-identification of the social classes. We have the three different locations that we actually have houses in. Tacoma, which is about 30 miles north of Olympia. Grace Harbor is about 50 miles east, or west, excuse me, and then Olympia. And you can see that in Tacoma and Grace Harbor, there's significantly higher in working class and below. And we did do the working class and below, the working class, low income, and poor. We had that all grouped into one. And then as you move into middle class and upper class, you see that Olympia exceeds the.
Yeah, the Tacoma campus is the majority African American faculty is as well. And Tacoma and Grace Harbor are sort of old industrial communities.
Then we looked at their self-identification, the same three categories or school locations as childhood. And again, you can see that Tacoma and Grace Harbor, again, self-identify with working class and below. And then Grace Harbor is just a touch below Olympia for middle class, and then upper class and Olympia far exceeds as far as the percentages.
And we're using slide to collapse for low income and working class into the category that we're calling working class.
And again, fathers and education by location. And AA and below, again, Tacoma and Grace Harbor are, you know, over 70% and just under 70% for fathers that have AAs and below. And that kind of helps identify the fact that they didn't have the, as they were growing up, they didn't have the means to help their kids go to college or know how to get into college. BA and above, graduate and doctorate, Olympia exceeds, and that's nobody in the other two areas, locations, even have doctorate degrees.
Yeah, and we had to make a distinction. We decided most associates of arts or vocational technical degrees produce working class occupations. And so that's why we chose AA and below rather than some college, because it's a little bit more, on the survey, it's a little more interesting.
So we did a comparison of day and evening maintenance students that they self-identify today. Day students, they consider themselves poor, low income, above the evening and weekend students. Evening and weekend students are working class. And yet day students flip-flop back, and they consider themselves middle class, upper class, and upper middle class. And this could be, because
the origin.
Yeah. When you look at the family origin, the evening and weekend students exceed low income and poor. You look at working class too, excuse me. Then you look at the day students and their middle class, and upper class. So even though they self-identify as poor or worker, low income, they come from middle class and above.
Yeah, and we found on the rising side of the scale, people thought they were doing better than their family origins. And the falling part of the scale, they thought they were doing worse. Or they identified as generally in a lower status. So we hit the age,
Yeah, and then we have the age. Of course, the day students, 15 to 20-year-old, 45% are day students. And then you see the evening and weekend start to exceed the day students at the age of 25 on up. I think it's 35 to 55. There's only less than 5% total that are attending day classes. And then the age of students by three different locations. So you can see when you get to 35 to 55, well, actually 35 to 44, Grace Harbor is well up there. Tacoma campus, if there's actually no day student at the Grace Harbor campus.
Right. No young students. Yeah, and this is our resident, non-resident breakout, the out-of-state students. So we found that,
non-resident, of course, they're going to be self-identifying as middle class, upper middle class, and upper class. So they can afford intuition. And then we looked at payday loans. I don't know if you have payday loans.
Oh, yeah.
But it was very interesting. Again, the two more depressed locations, Grace Harbor and Tacoma, there's a greater majority of people that do take out payday loans, but usually for Olympia, very few people do.
We use that as a real class marker. So we brought copies of a report for the end after everyone's done. And Cindy, just have a couple words.
What we learned. So during the survey and learning about class really made us look at us, ourselves and our biases and beliefs and what we thought class was. When we met in our group, in our seminars for the, our seminar groups for the first time, majority of people believe that income was the majority factor in determining one's class status. However, after working on the survey and doing the, reading several theories by authors, Weber, Mills, Mark, and many more, we found that class is much more complicated than we anticipated. So through the group discussion, we were able to acknowledge the importance of social status and the way this notion of occupational status and the power it does or does not entail. And we did find a lot of unchallenged biases about class and intelligence. We found that with the dominance of seminars and small group work at the college, it really dispelled the beliefs or fears about intelligence in class. We also believe that studying class has enabled most of us in the class to really think about class more often, help us understand the role of other people in other classes, having even empathy for those people, and not just to see as poverty, but class as a big system of power.
Thank you. Well, let me just ask one informational question. Sure. What is the in-state tuition there?
$1,900
for a quarter. For in-state?
For a quarter.
Yes,
for a quarter.
So just under
$2,000.
How
is that compared
with here?
If it's $6,000 a year, then it's a three-quarter year.
Yeah.
Comparable to student tuition. Okay, yeah. Our second panel is empathy, the placebo effect. And our presenters are Heather Holley, who's assistant professor and coordinator of communication at the University of Akron, Wayne College. She's a member of the Working Class Study Association, and she's on the Diversity and Outreach Committee of the WCSA. And E.R. Carlin lists his educational background as including Youngstown State, Tavern on the Green, Red Lobster, and an MFA at Pacific Lutheran. He's a graduate student in English at University of Akron, and he's a well-published poet in quite a number of reputable poetry and small magazines. So, tell us about that.
Okay. I'm going to be introducing, and I'll come in a little bit at the end, and my partner will be doing the crux of the presentation. She's better. So, I thought first what I would do is entering the discourse community of empathy as even as a word, as a notion. It goes back centuries and centuries, right? And so I thought I would define it a little bit. So, just so you have an idea of empathy, because you can get so many definitions out there. So, define it in the context of our presentation. So, the first way I want to define it, we'll lead into our handout at the end, is John Keats defines negative capability as a sort of emptying of self, suspending judgment, so as to imagine others and even the natural from the inside. This approach, often we point to empathy today, involves projecting, or as Keats once wrote in a letter dated October 27, 1818, he, the poet, is continually in for and filling some other body. So he's basically talking about the idea of trying to get a heightened sense of imagination in there. And so I will come back to that definition because I like that one. You know, if you're a poet, you'll know that one. But now I'm going to go to some more modern definitions and where we're going to get into some of the problematics of how it's defined today. Jeremy Rifkin. New book, The Empathetic Civilization, The Race to Global Consciousness in a World in Crisis, 2010, defines empathy as foundational. Empathy represents the deepest expression of all, and understandably is regarded as the most spiritual of human qualities. Empathy becomes the window to the divine. It is by empathetic extension that we transcend ourselves and begin to connect with the mystery of existence. In the empathetic civilization, spirituality invariably replaces religiosity. If empathy did not exist, we could not understand why we feel the way we do, or conceptualize something called an emotion, or think rationally. Okay? The next definition is a current one I want to give you by George Lakoff, distinguished professor of cognitive science and linguistics at the University of California, Berkeley, and Obama cheerleader. His definition, empathy is why we have the values of freedom, fairness, and equality for everyone, not just for certain individuals. If we put ourselves in the shoes of others, we will want them to be free and treated fairly. Empathy, which always leads to equality, and empathy ultimately leads to democracy. Okay, that's his definition. And what's interesting is he keeps on writing about Obama. These quotes. And so he defines, so I'm going to lead off or end with this before we go into the presentation. This is from Obama's recent address on the oil spill from May 27, 2010 in the press conference. This is quoted in Lakoff's article as going back to the old Obama, the sense of the Obama in the beginning of the campaign who had empathy. And this is Obama's words from his press conference. I think everyone understands that when we are following the earth like this, it has concrete implications, not just for this generation, but for future generations. I grew up in Hawaii, where the ocean is sacred. And so sometimes when I hear folks down in Louisiana expressing frustrations, I may not always think that their comments are fair. On the other hand, I probably think to myself, these are folks who grew up fishing in these wetlands and seeing this as an integral part of who they are. And to see that mess up in this fashion must be infuriating. Okay, so this is my partner. We're already going to go into it. She'll be discussing some of the problematics, and she'll be talking, addressing this quote I just told you about, and ways in which we think of empathy and reshape it.
Okay, so I'm going to outline five problematics with empathy. Our research, we included popular media sources and popular texts, like the empathy gap, the empathetic civilization. We also looked at academic articles on empathy, both in the humanities, but also in medical literature. And we also use our own and others' teachers' experiences of teaching empathy. Empathy is a common course goal, for example, in many classes, particularly in communication and English classes, but also in multicultural classes and classes focusing on class. So the four problematics that I'll outline are identity tourism, the reduction of lived experience to personal identification, the reduction of social constructions into identity features, and the reduction of experience into aesthetically pleasing personal narratives, and also communication, the placebo effect, and I'll talk about that a little bit at the end. Identity tourism. This is the experimental process by which a person takes on another identity. It's analogous to visiting a country like a tourist. In Papino's 2005 discussion of identity themes, she argues that when students read multicultural or class-related literature, they deliberately pick out pieces of others' identity and experience to relate to their own, and they construct that experience accordingly. Thus, characters that are similar to them are likable, and characters that are dissimilar to them are dislikable. But students rarely are able to go beyond that to understand what structures those their class identities. One of the most interesting experiences that I had as a teacher is teaching multicultural communication. If you've ever taught multicultural literature or multicultural communication, you find it is virtually impossible to pick out a textbook on that subject. Most of the time, the textbooks are filled, certainly in communication, with blurbs from students from other countries who talk about their experiences or talk about their rituals in a very reductive, very short way. And one of the challenges that I found in teaching multicultural communication was that, at best, my students were able to find similarities between themselves and others through common rituals or common experiences, but they never went beyond the tourist function. In other words, they never were able to find good constructive ways to talk about dissimilarities, nor were they sometimes even able to recognize how their conditions were dissimilar to other people's conditions and how that constructed experience. The next problematic is the reduction of lived experience to personal identification. And I just want to read this Obama quotation because I found this shocking. I found Lakoff's article. Lakoff's article is printed on Common Dreams. His article is entitled Obama's Missing Moral Narrative. It appears on May 28, 2010, so you're free to look at it. He makes an interesting argument that if Obama would simply return to the campaign Obama, the empathy Obama, and he communicated the right message, that would magically transform him to do some good things. So President Obama said the following in this press conference. I think everybody understands that when we're fouling the earth like this, it has concrete implications, not just for this generation, but for future generations. I grew up in Hawaii, where the ocean is sacred. And so sometimes when I hear folks down in Louisiana expressing frustrations, I may not always think that their comments are fair. On the other hand, I probably think to myself, and I really like that phrase, you might not think, but he probably thinks to himself, that these folks who grew up fishing in these wetlands and seeing this as an integral part of who they are, and to see that as messed up in this fashion would be infuriating. And bizarrely, Lakoff describes this response as empathetic. Lakoff and Obama both fall into the assumption that personal identification, in other words, being to identify with someone, is the same as sharing their experiences. While it may be true that Louisiana fishers see fishing as integral to their identity, it is a fact that they depend on fishing for their livelihood that is so significant, something neither Obama or Lakoff acknowledged. Similarly, when students read about discrimination, they often relate to their own experiences of discrimination, essentially unfairness. So one of the things I found is that students, I do a journalism series called the Times-Picayune series on racism, which is where the Times-Picayune explored its, the own racist implications of its newspaper. And students often read that series and say, well, I can relate to that. One time someone treated me unfairly, and that really is awful. And so there's that basic relationship. But we argue that while this may be a good beginning for some students, it is a very dangerous place to end because it ignores so many of the other experiential factors. This same personal identification business also came to light when students on my campus were doing something called Up Till Dawn. Probably it happens on your college campuses too, where undergraduate students spend the night in the campus. They lock themselves in somewhere. They usually go for 24 hours without eating. And the event, in this case, the Up Till Dawn, was to understand famine in Darfur. So, you know, here's the circumstance of this experience. Students get together with their iPods and their sleeping bags, and they all see a big group, and they have a great time, and they talk about genocide. And then they come out, and faculty made them a big breakfast. At the end, and they say, wow, you know, famines are really terrible. But what they got out of that experience was extremely positive bonding, and they missed so many of the lessons that I think we're trying to be taught. So when we equivocate experiences, when we substitute personal identification for real exploration of experience, I think we have a real problem. The next problematic is the reduction of social constructions into identity features. The embodied experiences of social groups are often reduced to specific identity features. As Bourdieu suggests, class becomes a set of cultural distinctions rather than socially constructed and cultivated political distinctions. The reduction also occurs on other levels. So students begin to see race and class as something that we all share. So black is the same as white. Heterosexual is the same as homosexual. We just have sexual preferences. Working class is the same as middle class. We all have class, so we all share class. So these features become reduced to something that all of us share. We all have our own traditions and rituals, and it fails to capture, again, this salient nature of experiences. If any of you watch the Colbert Report, I think Stephen Colbert captured this nicely when he always says, "I don't see color." For students, that phrase, for people, that phrase makes sense in certain ways because they see race as a feature of identity, something which I choose to take on and off, rather than as a set of culturally constructed power relations. Finally, the reduction of experience as aesthetically pleasing personal narratives. One of the things that happens, I think, in any classroom is that we encourage students to write reflections. We encourage them to revise those reflections. And ultimately, when we begin to discuss issues of race in class, the drive to move that into the aesthetic, I think is quite powerful and problematic. I'm running out of time, so I'm just going to describe these briefly, what we think are some ways to rethink empathy, and we're going to give you a handout on these. Perspective taking, intersubjectivity, reframing, and agency. So Ed, I'll let you talk about yours as well.
You're just going to hand out?
Okay. Perspective taking refers to the ability to recognize the perspectives of others. Maybe the most powerful thing we want to explain to our students is that they don't understand, that they simply cannot understand. Intersubjectivity, I use Merleau-Ponty's notion of intersubjectivity here. Reframing, I can talk about that more in the question and answer session. And for agency, I use Peter Singer's notion of agency. What we're passing out here is a handout of what I just talked about, and we're also passing out an assignment. This is an assignment that both of us have used in literature courses or in communication courses. We start with a poem end with a conclusion. We start off with this poem. It's a poem by Larry Levitt. And we have students read the poem and talk about the poem in one session, and then go home and research the differences in definition between sympathy and empathy. Then we have a packet from the journal Countermeasures in which that poem is discussed and critiqued by various poets. So on the second day, we pass out that Countermeasures packet and discuss with the students those critiques, then have them choose the responses that are both similar and dissimilar. And then we end the discussion by talking about what constitutes empathy. Can we have empathy? What does it mean to not understand something? When have we felt demeaned when someone says, "I understand what you are going through"? And that assignment and the instructions are there. And I'll just let ER close with some tenets, some final thoughts on empathy.
Yeah, these aren't in the handout. These are more of us thinking about it, all our research and articles we're looking at. The basic tenets, in addition to perspective taking, intersubjectivity, reframing, and agency, I think empathy probably works best when it's non-foundational. Empathy should be defined by its consequences. We should reject seeing empathy as a binary in either-or relations. Empathy should oppose the violence and demeaning nature of abstractions, especially calcified and dogmatic abstractions. Empathy works best when it is a process leading to discovery, creativity, and further dialogue. One of the mechanisms of intersubjectivity and perhaps empathy is celebrating the newness of each experience. Empathy and intersubjectivity are ongoing processes. Empathy is reciprocity. It is, as Leslie Baxter describes, an aesthetic moment between two people where we see and experience the world together. So, that's just a few extras.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Are you going to use the gesture?
Yeah.
Okay, our third presentation is by Joel Sachs. It's Generational Debt, Catalyst to Social Change, and Critical Class/Classroom Consciousness. Mr. Sachs teaches communications at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He's a documentary filmmaker, and he's worked with both troubled youth and elderly Jewish radicals.
And I don't know if they're organically related or not.
Okay. This all works here. Okay. What I want to talk about is a course that I've been developing at UMass Amherst Department of Communication, Youth Democracy in the Entertainment Industries. But I'm going to start with, I just want to read a little bit. One of the things that we've been doing in the course is working with blogs and kind of the cyber comics, so to speak. So I want to start out by just looking at one of these and reading a little bit as a beginning. This is Erica America, Gen Dead in My Eyes. And if we get the light,
it's readable.
Is that okay?
I'll see if I don't know if I can dim it. I will.
Okay. Excerpts from a class paper on generational debt. That's great. Actually, you know what? I would be helpful. I'll start out reading, and then we'll go around, and everybody can read a paragraph, if that's okay. In terms of my own economic standpoint, and one thing you'll see here, these are not all hyper-text links. We're working with, my background is a filmmaker, and a lot of my teaching has been in art departments. And now I'm doing more academic teaching, and so it's hard for me to leave the studio art setting. And the right-left brain, as I began teaching as a lecturer in different places, I was very interested in how to bring art into the classroom and kind of right-left brain fusing the two. So bringing a studio art-making sensibility into an academic classroom, and we'll see what that looks like. So part of what I'm pushing them is, what does it mean to design blogs, work with colors, work with fonts, et cetera, et cetera. So that's in terms of my own economic standpoint, I'm feeling the utmost financial pressures and strains. My parents are divorced, and being on my father's side of the divorce agreement places me under his financial support. Let's see. Sir, would you, can you read next?
You know, I have my own students do this, and it always works really well. But all right, so he too is enduring severe economic problems. He lost his job of almost 20 years. He can barely make ends meet. He helps me when possible, but I almost completely support myself. I've been able to attend college because of financial aid, and it does not completely cover all of my expenses.
Okay, next.
I have to work double shifts on the weekends in order to pay for my rent, food, clothing, school fees, and other life necessities, all of which really add up. Between classes Monday through Friday and working 25 hours between Saturday and Sunday, I am completely exhausted and drained.
Financial burdens have also forced me to take out a credit card, which I am also in debt with.
I've always been an overachiever, graduating high school a year early and now college a semester early. But recently I've had a hard time primarily focusing on my schoolwork. I simply do not have the time I want and need, nor the energy to work to my full potential. This also leaves me feeling dissatisfied with myself.
I also do not have time for social life, whether it is because of social schoolwork, work, or just the energy to join.
I anticipate being able to work more, but I'm worried about finding a stable salary-based job post-graduation. I know the job market is at its worst, but the employment situation in the U.S. is it's worse than most people realize, but it is not a lot for employment.
Next.
Also paying off my loans will only add to my financial struggles, as author Kamenetz explains in Generational Debt. More students work their way through college with sizable loans to pay off afterwards.
Every day I feel consistent anxieties and worries over money, whether or not I can make the rent, pay my bills, etc.
If there were any way money was not a worrisome factor in my life, I cannot imagine the academic and communal achievements I could put at risk.
However, I cannot imagine ever being
in
a safely
from
a situation.
Okay, so
posted by
your also. This is pretty typical, and this comes out of the premise of the course, Youth Democracy and Entertainment Industries, is that young people exercise a tremendous amount of
As we may know, for those people who deal with advertising communications, young people are a pivotal source of capital, discretionary income in our economy. So the question is, if young people, as this one, those born from 82 to 2000 have purchasing power more than $200 billion a year, influencing as much as half of all spending in the economy. Tremendous force there in terms of through the nag factor, PESCO power, et cetera, what the influence is. So the question that I put to students is, to the extent that you pay for the entertainment industries, it's your money, everything that we buy, the cost of advertising is built into it, your shoes, your dresses, your everything you eat, you're paying for what we see on TV, what we get. What do we get? What do you actually get in terms of representation? So that's the kind of question. And then from that, the question of democracy. What does democracy mean in our society? And the first class would brainstorm just in terms of words. Terms. What does it mean to you? And last term we came up with, in terms of break students into groups, and, well, what does this mean? What does it mean for you? Choice, voice, vote, participation, and then I added equal rights, right? So we came back to that throughout the term. And then the question is, okay, how does that idea of choice, voice, vote relate to the entertainment industries? And on a larger level, how do we relate the principle of democracy to the economy? And there's this schism that goes on. So that's how we start out. The first part of the term, the first kind of third, students construct their own kind of autobiographies as consumers. And we do that in different ways. Then we look at what an alternative economic paradigm would look like, the Adbusters culture jamming model, the DIY economy, so that there's some sense of what an alternative could be in terms of consuming less and how going from a GNP, GDP to a degrowth society. What that would look like. Then we look at two primary issues. And the goal here towards the end of the term is, what would a youth agenda for representation look like? If we apply the principles of democracy to the media industries, you're paying for it. What do you want? What do you want in terms of representation? Two primary issues we read about before we get to kind of them taking on whatever issues they decide are important. And that's problematic, which I won't get into. But we look at urban youth inequities, the prison industrial complex, as one primary issue, which doesn't generally touch most of the young people that I'm teaching. I have 30 to 35 students in this seminar, upper level seminar. There are usually several young people of color who have touched that. Some have also had other people in lockup. But generally, most of the young people don't have that. They come from the suburbs outside of Boston. So we look at urban youth inequities, and then we look at generational debt. And that term, generation debt, comes from a book by Anya Kamenetz, a young blogger who has a new book out, DIYU, Ed U. Pumps. And she's got tremendous influence in the blogosphere in terms of kind of this dialogue. So if you go to The Narrow Bridge, it's her blog, and it'll take you to her new blog, DIYU. We do readings on generation debt, and what I have students do in terms of the exercise is they interview cohorts. My background is oral history, ethnography, so I have students do some of that and think about kind of what is the drama, what is our narrative, what don't we see in terms of what's foreground in the media that's targeting youth, what are your stories, what are the stories of your generation? And these hit home in a very deep way. So they interview cohorts, they do 3 to 5 interviews, and I was going to have us read some of this, but the visual will be good. Then they're required, and they've done this already, I've had them do interviews around consuming youth, where they interview the parents on what was the experience for the parent growing up, the nag factor of the pressures that the parent felt. So that's the first. Now they go second, they interview their parents again in terms of what is the experience of generational debt for you. So this narrative that Erica, America shares, comes in part from going back and talking to her father, talking to other cohorts, writing about that. What's my time, sir?
About 10 minutes.
Short 10 minutes, okay. So they interview cohorts, they interview their parents, they write about it, and then they create illustrations about it. And let me just get through all of this. So this is the first, I wanted to just start out with this. So they've already done illustrations on their histories as consumers in the first part of the term, and this is the second set of illustrations. They can do black and white illustrations, cartooning, collages, whatever they want to do. But how do you interpret your experience? How do you interpret the readings and images?
this says so much in terms of, and it's a question that I put to all of us, is what are we doing? Part of the question here for me, or kind of as I frame this presentation, with students facing this issue of tremendous debt, of not getting jobs, of downward mobility, we're all part of this factory. We're part of this mode of production. We're here at this kind of Marxist-oriented conference to some extent. So to say, well, here we are in a university, in an academic building, in this institution. What is our relationship? Marx, or not Marx particularly, Engels talks about false consciousness. We have that debate that goes on. But this idea that we're all in this institution, we're all part of this structure of production. And we all, in some ways, have these force blinders on, where we work with this premise that we're going to train students to get a job, right? We don't talk about the debt involved. We don't talk about the fact that there really aren't that many jobs out there. We all know that more now than ever. So this idea, I thought to myself, and to some extent talked with colleagues about, we're leading them off like lemmings, you know, like sheep to the cliff. I didn't tell the student this. She did this on her own. But it kind of speaks to that question of what are we all doing here? Kind of in terms of the crisis of capitalism and how it's in our own classrooms in terms of what we are producing. So these are some of the and let me just while we're looking at these, let me talk about, okay, so we look at the issue of how in a classroom, in a college classroom, do we think about this crisis that we're facing, the crisis of capitalism, as it affects our own immediate classrooms, the subjects, objects that we're teaching. What do we do? And how do we apply popular education, Freire's notion of popular education, model to the classroom? Telling our stories, identifying generative themes, problem posing, what are the questions, and what do we do? So what are the responses? And we're going to look at these images, and let me just, while we're looking at them, I'm going to summarize the ways in which, after doing this learning, students respond. This first set of images, learner responses to generational debt. First of all, frustration, disappointment, disillusionment, betrayal, cynicism, pessimism, hopelessness, powerlessness, particularly related to economic prospects. Can you see this one?
Oh.
UMass Journalism Department, a modern spin on professional darts. So this sense of betrayal, downward mobility, lowered expectations. After, I also do a kind of reader's theater process where people then select excerpts from the narratives and read them in class. And the first time I did it, which was 2 years ago, after we went around and did this, the quiet in the room, you know, was deafening. I mean, it was the somber, the sense of gloom that students felt. And so then the response is just this tremendous pessimism, like, what can we do? Cynicism, there's nothing we can do. So that's, and I argue, and there's responses to that. and more details. This comes in part from... so here's the debt. So that's the first one, this sense of frustration, disappointment. Two, a critique of the existing power structure, the economy, capitalism, the financial looming class, bailed out banks, politicians, summarized, epitomized by this quote, they're looking out for the CEOs, but what about the middle class? Now one could say, ask the question of this idea of frustration, disappointment, and critique of the power structure, which is the least expressed element. It's not something they necessarily come to on their own. But in terms of Habermas's notion of the legitimation crisis, we could say, or could we say, that we are now in a legitimation crisis in terms of capitalism, where people don't believe the system is working. Francis Fox Bibb and Richard Plower, Poor People's Movements, we all know that book, Why They Succeed, How They Fail, say that there are three bases for social movements. Number one, the legitimation crisis, people no longer believe in the system. Number two, a sense of rights, expectations. We have a right to something different. So So the women's movement, out of the civil rights, black power movement, what about us, right? Sarah Evans writes about that. In terms of the civil rights movement, the black GIs who came back after World War II fighting fascism and seeing the lynching is cited as an important part of the basis for the civil rights movement. Expectations are raised. Students have no expectations that things should be different. Number three, a sense of agency, capacity, organizational possibility. There is no sense of that. Right.
Well, what I was going to go through these,
it's a wonderful experience. Let me just show you one blog. Let me get out of here. They do some amazing blogs here. Stress the life of a college student, and it goes on. These are all dealing with different levels of consumerism and responses to it. This is some African American students looking at real shit, living beyond our means, and kind of that pattern. And I had this with Erica America, I didn't get to see it, but I happened to use cell phones to picture what it looks like. And she had her brother, her younger brother in Boston, take self pics of his closet and email them to her. And then they did this dialogue back and forth. Where I wanted to leave us was kind of this question of what do we model in the academy? What kind of practices do we offer students in terms of a sense of that it could be different, in terms of social change? So I guess that's it. Is anybody else kind of using this?
Not me. Okay. Okay, our fourth presentation is Students' Gaze in the Working Class Mirror, Teaching the Working Class Experience in America. Ray Masurek grew up in Lawrence, Massachusetts. Was your family the American Woman Mill?
No.
Okay. And he teaches English at Penn State at Reading, and he has a PhD in American Studies in Purdue, and he's done extensive work on working class and higher education and academics in labor.
Not extensive, but anyway, some of these are academic labor, it's one of my sessions. Okay, for the past 5 years, I've been teaching an Introduction to American Studies course at the Berks campus of Penn State with a working class emphasis. 2005 and 2006, I taught a version of it as Work in America, and since 2008, I taught the course as the Working Class Experience in America. And I have copies of the syllabus if you're interested. Although the earlier version was one of 10 Penn State courses, all courses in American Studies and Women's Studies that David Horowitz singled out to attack as propaganda in an online article and a recent book entitled One Party Classroom, the course has sought in all of its versions to help students work out their own ideas about America's complex class history. Horowitz's attack is basically a simplistic analysis of the politics of the books that appeared on the syllabus, which was found online. Though, as one of my colleagues at University Park put it, it places me momentarily in the inner circle of academics who Horowitz has indirectly honored. But actually, it relates to academic labor. I read the online article. I only read my part in the book. But 10 courses were attacked. I was the only tenured professor. And there was one emeritus guy that was attacked. But it was a relationship between this conflict from the right and our powerlessness, our lack of power in our jobs in academia. And I was the only person on the campuses.
Wow.
There's this big class thing between the campuses and the main campus. I'll talk about that. But anyway, its most recent version, American Studies 100, begins with a brief discussion of the concept of working class. We then shift to a historical survey. We use Coles and Zandi's American working class literature. But the midterm, we have a theoretical center, which is where we read the working class majority in Michael Zweig's book, and students write a review of the book. We have one class where they can ask questions before they write the review. I don't say anything about the book, they just ask questions. So it sort of gives a version of their ideas about class. I'm going to focus on that. When we continue the survey with the Depression and contemporary period, and we read Studs Terkel's working, and they write an oral history also at the end. So My paper focuses on students' reactions and resistance to slight arguments in their essays, and rather than indoctrinating students, American Studies 100 offers a significant forum for students to explore conflicting ideas about the very unstable concept of class in 21st century. We begin with some basic ideas. We look at the General Social Survey from 1972 to 2006, where about half Americans identify themselves as working class, about half as middle class, and that's consistent. We look at some statistics, mostly from a book called Economic Apartheid in America, which show that up from 1945 to 1970s, income was coming together, that the greater increases in income were in the lower groups, and then after about 1980, there's this great increasing inequality. And we look at some statistics from Penn State. For example, the 17 Commonwealth campuses, the branch campuses that were once two-year campuses, of which the one I teach is one of those. It used to be a two-year campus until 1997. They have different SAT scores and different average family incomes than the main campus. The main campus has higher SAT scores, and the average family income is in the second highest quintile, whereas the branch campuses are in the middle quintile in income. So we talk about that as sort of like a generative theme to start out thinking about that. It's obvious that on one hand, students resist the idea that class is there, but it's obvious something's going on. So then we shift into the survey. I just want to mention my major themes, which are the invention of the white race. We do some stuff with Theodore Allen's work about how whiteness is invented to divide the working class, and that America is about this dance between race and class that are always heavily interrelated. I don't think they get it entirely, but we read some of the things in the Zandi and Cole's book, and point out how some of Frederick Douglass's ideas prefigure Allen, and look at, try to talk about race as one of the reasons why America doesn't have such a distinct idea of class. Then we look at early industrialism. We do life in the iron mills. We do, we spend a lot of time with, sometime with David Montgomery's idea about the strength of class unionism and class conflict in industrial America. I guess we do some fairly standard things. And mid-semester, when they read the working class majority, the discussion of Montgomery and workers' control is in part designed as a lead-in to Zweig. Because as you get, how many people have read the Zweig book, Working Class Majority? Okay. Well, Montgomery's work talks about how much autonomy unions had in the late 19th century, the crafts unions. They almost sound like the middle class, professional class in Michael Zweig's book, which have some autonomy in their work, but not as much as capital. And so Zweig, as you know, defines class as based in power and not income. He says class is not based on income, but income has a great deal to do with class. In general, the more power and authority, the higher income the occupation carries. But basically, he defines class in terms of power. Capitalists have power. Workers are people without autonomy in the job. And in the middle, you have small capitalists and professionals like tenured faculty who have a fair degree of autonomy and so forth. And this notion is odd and difficult for students to accept in a lot of ways. I think there's also a relationship that if they're wanting to feel that the middle class is the major class, it partly comes from their being part of American culture that tells them that most people are middle class. But I think there's something else going on looking at my students' responses, and that is if you take where they are, where the average family incomes are, then many of them are actually in families in the borderline between upper working class and middle class. So I think there's something else going on there. But anyway, I want to talk about students' responses. Talk about 30 of 45 student papers written in the fall of 2009. These are the people who allowed me to use their papers. There's some talk a little bit about students' responses in their reviews. Many students like the book, even if they find it difficult to accept all of its arguments. Student number 28 notes, although the book included a lot of statistics, which I wasn't particularly fond of, I thought the book was good and interesting. I have never quite read a book like Zweig's. Disagreements take several forms. Some students adopt the belief that class is irrelevant in today's society. Indeed, their everyday lives often offer little reinforcement of the idea that we live in a class society, even if they are, by many measures, many of them are by many measures, members of the working class. Student number 13 speaks for many when she says, I think the lines are so thin between what is considered middle and what is considered working class. Similarly, student number 10 writes, I have a hard time believing that the separation of classes is as drastic between the middle class and the working class as Zweig thinks. She observes that her father is able, after long years, to move up from being a cop to being a supervisor, only to find that he liked being an ordinary cop better. Money and status aren't everything, she notes in the conclusion of her essay. Many students who see class lines as arbitrary read Zweig's book as an attempt to label or classify the many occupations in America and focus on the distinction between the middle class and the working class in Chapter 1. These students often miss the developed definition of class and power and the basic conflict between labor and capitalist structures class, according to Zweig. Others, however, see the relevance of the issue of power, but still wish to keep the common sense terminology where the working class is the lower class. There are three kinds of middle class, and there is an upper class. Student number 31 presents a thoughtful version of this argument, saying that, like Zweig, he, and quote, agrees that the working class has to work harder for less. This is why there is an increase in higher educational programs, because there is a higher desire for more skilled workers in today's society. Yet with this increase for higher skilled workers, this changes the classes again. For student 21, the lower middle class would be those with almost zero autonomy, working the typical 9-to-5 grind weekly. He retains the language that's familiar from the rhetoric of everyday life, while agreeing with the basic thrust of Zweig's argument with its focus on power. Zweig is not quite acceptable because, as the student says, and I quote, I don't think you can divide the classes that broadly and they run together too much. Yet however you divide them, this seems to occur. The division of classes is very important for society so that we can examine where the power is in our society. Student number 24 gives a careful summary of Zweig's ideas about class and power. However, he's troubled by Zweig's discussion of capitalism. I quote again, as I finished reading and summarizing Zweig's opinionated informative literature, I noticed a couple of recurrent ideas. Zweig constantly attacks America's current economic privatization, suggesting that capitalism is a flawed system. The student suggests that, quote, Zweig seems to favor a socialistic economic system where all workers are equal and have the same incomes. This obviously was tried in the USSR, and while the idea is one of social perfection, it could never work because of the vast differences in labor. I find this interesting, just the only student who connected the book and power with the idea of socialism and with the USSR, and he's the only student that used the S word at all in the discussion of the book. It's kind of interesting how that word is missing from the book also, if we could talk about. But the student dismisses the working class of the past, saying, and I quote, that those who haven't made strides for change are simply too ignorant and uneducated to make a stand. But nevertheless, he sees hope for workers in the future, claiming that, and I quote, since higher education is becoming a necessity in our capitalistic workplace, I feel as if the next generation of workers will demand greater rights and better opportunities for the future. He and his generation will demand more power and autonomy. Other students accept Zweig's ideas the working class is the majority. Several, such as two students who were friends, wrote using the same words, I now understand what class I am. Or in student 17 words, and I quote, people are realizing as well as myself that they are not necessarily middle class. Others are skeptical of the idea that America is a middle class society. Student number 16 wrote, people are always going to be fully aware there is a working class. Any person that goes to Camden or certain areas of Philadelphia knows that this theory, that most Americans are middle class, is definitely not true. Student 16 also seizes upon the idea that unions can restore workers' power, which she writes, many unions seem like an idea of the past, but why can't we make them a part of the future? Student number two sees parallels between Zweig's book and Michael Moore's movie Capitalism, A Love Story, and she says, and I quote, "If the picture he's painted of American classes and the power that they wield is accurate, then I'm nervous for the future. I guess I would say that capitalism is meant to be a good thing, but self-interest has turned to greed of the capitalist class." Student number nine calls Zweig's book a wake-up call to the working class people of America. He challenged the working class majority of the country to unite for a common cause, to claim the power that their numbers could command. This student also connected the recent election of Barack Obama to the working class's potential to awaken. However, students who see themselves as working class and see the working class majority as a wake-up call in the majority resists Zweig's argument. Perhaps the biggest point of resistance is over upward mobility. Student 10 writes, and I quote, "Zweig says moving up or changing classes is almost impossible, but I disagree." And she gives the example of her father's ambiguous rise from cop to supervisor as an example. He was the one who was happier as an ordinary cop. Student 27 takes issue with Zweig's analysis of the role of luck in upward mobility, saying that luck has nothing to do with the status of an individual. Student 28 argues that, and I quote, "it's a proven fact in most cases, the harder one works, the more successfully they normally are in achieving their goals." His writing betrays an interesting vacillation between certainty, it's a proven fact, and qualifying words, in most cases and normally. The idea that upward mobility might not be the result of hard work is hard for many of my students to accept. No one reflects this unwillingness more than student 23, a very bright young Hispanic woman who was in my freshman writing class the year before. She writes, and I quote, "the working class is a class I can definitely relate to. My parents are very hard workers that over time have been able to buy a very nice home, own five cars, and put me and my brother through college. Don't get me wrong, we all don't drive 2010 model cars, but all the cars we own are reliable transportation. My brother and I work full-time jobs to pay for our living expenses." So Zweig expresses that most people don't really have a chance for class mobility. He feels that luck has to play a major role for someone to be able to change classes. Then he also states that, she quotes Zweig here, "there seems to be no relationship at all between the occupation of college graduates and the occupation of their fathers, suggesting that a college education does provide a ticket out of the working class." That ends Zweig's quote. "I understand that class is something you're born into, but I also believe that one has the ability to move up. Social mobility is something that every American dreams of. Honestly, I don't know what other reason I would be going to school other than to one day provide my kids what my parents couldn't provide for me." End quote. My student points to the nuances in the working class majority, where Zweig admits that college has been somewhat of a class leveler, but she doesn't really analyze those nuances. Like many of my students, this student is caught up in the dream that college will provide a ticket out of the working class. It is hard for someone who has worked very hard to get to college to acknowledge that luck also played a role in her getting there. Books like The Working Class Majority challenge her identity, just like teaching the working class experience challenges mine. When I was asked to consider opening another section this fall, the course is popular. I hesitated. Telling the registrar of the course was an exhausting course to teach, and I think it is sometimes an exhausting course to take, partly because it does challenge, I think, some commonly held ideas. I don't remember to define the working class, but the working class is a term from the industrial age. It's a term that originated, if we are to believe Raymond Williams, as a call to identity from a world where workers organize, where unions and other workers' organization appears on the historical stage. And I think one reason why the word does not attract the same identity is because unions and workers' organizations are so weak, and for many of my students, invisible, though many of them will have a chance to be part of a union, because the most common major is elementary education, and the majority of students are female, so these students will have a chance to be part of a union, hopefully. What the term will mean in the 21st century, where workers' organizations are few and far between, is uncertain. The workers of the future, like my students, will decide whether or not to identify as a working class, but they surely will struggle for power, whatever language they choose to employ. Thank you.
So, thanks to self-discipline and occasional nudge from your cheerful chair, we went stuck to time, and we have a lot of time for comments, questions, discussion. There are a lot of panelists. Could I ask? It's not really useful to ask everyone to come to the front. One question for the panelists. Were you asked if you would sign this recording permissions agreement so the university library, which will keep the tape on archive, can use it in non-exclusive sense? If your agent is not happy with that, point out it's not exclusive, and your agent is also free to make any deal that she or he is able to. But let me ask at least one person from each panel, if you're willing to, at the end, to fill this out or give the position to use it enough. It allows people to go into the university web, the library web, and see the session. And I don't know what Michael's plans are regarding editing and publishing. Okay, enough from me. Let me open the floor to just a free-for-all questions to anybody and everybody. Please.
Okay,
yes,
Heather, yeah, I was really interested in your talk on empathy. And, yeah, I mean, in fact, you talked about dealing with students and encouraging empathy there. I'm wondering how you applied your findings to yourself as professors. I mean, I think we're often challenged empathy with students and sometimes odds where they just don't have papers, but, you know, with multicultural students. And, yeah,
I mean, I definitely, I think, you know, the same rule applies. That I think students, I taught at a private school for a while where students spent quite a lot of time at office, and now I teach at the University of Akron Lane College, which is a very different kind of school, a much more working class school. So I find myself actually identifying with my students much more now, but I still am quite careful to say, you know, wow, I really identify with you, or, oh, that really makes sense to me. But I think it's also important to sometimes say, you know, I'm not sure I understand, or I can't think of it a similar experience, or, you know, maybe even ask, how can I best, how should I respond in this situation, or can you help me, can you guide me with what you want me to do? Can you think of a solution to this problem? Because I think it can be very demeaning when someone says that they understand your experience or they know what you mean and they don't.
Mm-hmm. Let me add a side. Teaching students with whom you have little in common is also a fascinating challenge.
Oh, absolutely.
To try to break through to understand them, to get them. In some ways, the other side of the coin.
Absolutely.
Trying to reach them.
Absolutely, and when I taught at a private school for a while, it was a very bizarre experience because I'm one of the students that has, you know, had hundreds of thousands, over $100,000 in debt, and I was driving my sort of rattly ass car, and all my students would get out of their really expensive cars, and so I just, you know, when they said, I'm being a poor college student, well, I never stopped, you know, I'm not sure. So it was very difficult to empathize, but I found connections there as well. It was a very interesting experience.
Please.
Yeah, I'm Tim Shear from Brooklyn, National Writers Union. I'm often perplexed, I think, why so many people in the conference here and others make the distinction between either the working class or the middle class. Mm-hmm. And it's always confused me. To me, it's like saying you're either a mammal or you're an American. They're like totally different ways to classify. Thank you, I'm a writer. So. They're different, I mean, it's not either or. And to me, it's a different way of organizing or stratifying people. Middle class, to me, is a measure of economic wealth and security. And working class is your relation to capital, whether you own capital and you hire people and you invest, you know, you make money from investments, which is hiring people indirectly, or whether you sell your labor. And I hear it today, and I hear it at these conferences frequently, and I must say I'm very perplexed why there's this either-or. To me, they're not an either-or. They're different. They exist in different spheres. So I'd like to hear some of the presenters speak to that.
The discussion of empathy is interesting when I'm thinking about kind of how it relates to what I was doing here, because I noticed that the students and they were definitely in the minority. They came from lower working class backgrounds, you know, and in their narratives you can see and how they identify, because I myself come from a lower income background. And so, you know, it always, to expect students who come from affluence to really be oriented towards social change is generally unfair. Because why would they? In their experience, and when you talk about empathy, right, they've grown up with things. You know, that's what they know. And the young people of color or those who have less, they will come up to me after class more likely and talk to me. And there's a way in which they'll identify with things that I've named in the classroom. But it speaks to the challenge of creating critical consciousness among people who have been weaned on wealth and consumerism. Because there is no empathy in that. All you think about is yourself. And I think that's one of the problematics of class, you know, as a category of analysis to move towards somewhere else.
Can I just say one thing? I think at this Congress we struggle so hard to see the difference because we've struggled so hard to have working class recognized at all. But I agree with you, Tim, that we do kind of paint a picture that is a little extreme because there's an awful lot of sense of being unimportant.
Evergreen, I think in terms of critical consciousness and students being able to look for alternatives or be interested in change, the stereotype is the more privileged students are more political, and the more working class students are less politicized. It's interesting. But we discovered a lot of ways that there is a difference. And we could say it's your middle income and working class. But the whole idea in our survey and in our class and in discussions in our seminars, there's something real to the social capital that students get coming from families of professionals, for having relatives that have gone to college. There's, if you've seen that Frontline documentary, College Incorporated, we had 7 people in our group contract, and 5 of the 7 had been actively preyed upon by these for-profit colleges. And some of them didn't have the social capital to figure out what was fraud in higher education. So there's a lot of meaningful, when you get to higher education, there is a meaningful difference between having a professional or middle class family, as we let Barbara Ehrenreich and Michael Zweig define middle class, versus having a working class family that might have good income, a longshore family, you know, could have $100,000 income, but with relatively little social capital.
I was going to say, I come from a background, my mother was a public school teacher, and my father was a social worker in Chicago. Their 2 incomes were quite pitiful. Mm-hmm. And yet, on the other hand, they were very middle class in terms of security and culture.
Right, they were cosmopolitan, intellectual,
side of the way we normally would think.
It's almost like a graph where you're
This is a fascinating discussion. I think, you know, one of the reasons it's so that we wrestle with this concept of class, we know it's complex. We know it's not this, you know, these easy little boxes. But it seems to me that, in my experience, this popular notion that America is this almost classless society in which everybody defines themselves as middle class or uncritically removes an important element of analysis of power in society that has to do with economics, and that we sort of lost the vocabulary to be able to, or that many of our students have lost the vocabulary to be able to address and articulate. So I mean, one of the appealing things about this conference is that people really wrestle with this concept of class.
And we haven't gotten into the complications of gender or race or religion.
Right. Right.
I mean, we're dealing with a traditional, mostly white, somewhat African-American class structure. And of course, the real mix is people can tell me more complicated.
Can I put that on the board? Would you?
Yeah. Well, let's get back to the
No.
It's almost like
I don't think the state's in a budget crisis.
Yeah. It's an outcome and level of education.
You can pull up that screen. But,
if you have level of education and income, and you have low over time, which, and low, what we're talking about is where are you on this axis? On both of these axes, right?
Yes.
Right. Are you low income, but are you uneducated that your parents are social workers and so on? You would be over here, for example. And that might be an interesting way to try and organize where people are.
But can I just say one thing really quick?
Sure.
The advantage of using ZOLI is the capitalists are on the board. And my students want to argue, are we working class or middle class, but they forget the capitalists. And that is what you say, that's the center of power. And that's what you can't ignore. Otherwise, my wife grew up lower middle class, and I was very working class, my daughter's very middle class, but none of us matter in terms of power.
Right.
Whether we're working class or middle class.
Yeah. The other thing that's important here is wealth. Mm-hmm. I mean, the income that you have, I mean, of course, that's important, but without wealth, you don't really have security, and the working class people generally don't have the opportunity to build up that sort of wealth. And, even middle-class people, some people may have jobs as social workers and teachers, but if they come from middle-class or upper middle-class families where they have wealth, that gives them a real cushion. So that's an important variable.
There was one thing, the issue of power, and the one thing that you couldn't do with the survey was that the survey did tread on the dangerous territory of reducing class to an individual demographic characteristic, I am that, I have that, we're all different, blah, 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 of not being revealing in terms of how groups work together and how classes may define or defend their interests, whichever one may be. But I think we got around that through the materials that we were using. I don't think we really fell into a demographic or a purely demographic understanding of class. But it's something that you can't do with an instrument like this.
How much do your categories depend on self-perception, and how much were they rigidly defined through the statistical part of the course? I mean, did you set a limit? If you make above a certain amount, no matter how you make it, you're...
Income is a terrible measure for students because the more privileged you are, the less income you have when you're in college, right? Right. We did. We tested whether works don't work. We tested, have you inherited, expect to inherit, did your parents inherit, do you own stock? We even asked, is any member of your family on the board of a corporation? And we had under 5% yes, but then when we checked the self-identification of those people, we actually had 30% of them identify as upper class and upper middle. So we went back and forth and we checked one, not just self-identification, but we used other questions to validate whether our self-identification was somewhat accurate. And Cindy was saying, I really wanted to get into that middle class category and disentangle what that was, because she had said that, why don't you say,
the first day of class, I take a survey. And, of course, I don't know nothing about class at that time. I marked middle class based on income. And as the class went on and learning more about class, I really figured it was working class. So I'm really interested to see how many people believe that they're middle class and they're actually not, because that's really what people know. That's all they know.
Well, that's what I say. It goes back to this place.
My question for the Evergreen group is, how'd you get 500 people to answer 90 questions?
You lean on your colleague. You give 15 minutes of class time. You time the survey. We had to work and work and work on it, have a long survey in a short amount of time. We practiced, timed it, and then we went to our colleagues and said, would you give us 15 minutes? And then that way we didn't have the fault of a self-selected group. taking the survey, they were, you know, more or less, they weren't compelled. They didn't have to take it, but they were given time in class to take it. So, and we tried to get our sample distributed around the various possibilities of kinds of programs and locations. So we oversampled the evening and weekend to come. We oversampled the working class constituencies more, but we still had a large and vigorous daytime full-time sample. So, but it's a really, I highly recommend it as a technique, is to lean on banking reciprocity. Lean on people that will.
As you're, you mentioned about the faculty, the poets, and the business teachers. Are you all on a tenure track? Do you have a contingent class among your faculty?
Yes, I'm actually a part-time faculty, and I do have job security. But I was going to say there still is some stratification. It's not that we're unstratified, but we have been working towards equity from the beginning of the college. As administrators will do, a shadow class developed and grew and grew and grew to be just under half the population of the faculty by headcount. And we've been, with our union contract, we've been trying to move towards more equity measures and more, you know, permanent long-term jobs.
Per course salaries?
No, yeah, but we're at 90% pay equity for adjuncts to regular.
I had a question for Joel, because I've undertaken a similar course, and I teach at a community college, and we use the book Affluenza as sort of a semester-long thing in pursuit of more. And one of the comments that I constantly got was, well, our economy runs because we buy stuff, and what happens if we stop buying stuff? Then our economy will crash, and then what will happen? And I wonder if you had some.
Well, we addressed that directly, and that's why. Are you familiar with that, Buster's?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, that's the one text that they have to purchase. Everything else is online, which is like $7 or something, and I get the local bookstore to do it. And so we look at that critique in depth, and what a DIY economy, or that critique, and what the critique of Ad Buster's puts out in terms of a degrowth economy. So to really look at what does that kind of economy, what does it mean when everything's based on GNP, GDP? And we recently have Bhutan, which has Gross National Happiness Index. You know, there are now two models that have come out. And so to ask, well, does this measure how many people are poor? How many people are unhappy? How connected are families and communities to one another? And what are the bases upon which we judge what is a good, humane economy?
Yeah, because if the GDP is going up, it doesn't necessarily mean that society is doing better.
No, and
we're spending money, whether that's on war or cancer or whatever it is.
Or oil, right? Yeah. You know, and oil, I mean, as much as they're spending, this increases the GDP because there's more money going to the Gulf area, you know, for whatever they're going to try to do to clean it up. So that would be a kind of discussion that people could add. You know, ways to have people picture. I mean, that's one of the things, just to bring it back to this issue of class. You know, I think the construction of the middle class post-World War II, which is a very auspicious time in the history of the longevity of how we've been on this planet, is really a mythology. And class itself is a category that's created for I mean, it exists, right? But it's also an analytic category that divides people. Just as economism is a critique of unionism, right? Where the faculty union will argue for more money for universities, in general, the principle of more money for the state. But in fact, what we're focused on is we want more money for UMass, right? And so this way in which class becomes a divisive category. And so for the future, like, what we want a classless society. I mean, we want a society where people's needs are met, and what does that look like? And I think is where I'm lacking. That was one of the things I wanted to say, is that we don't have a larger vision to give to our students at this point of what a different society would look like.
Joel, do you ever get to the question of how people in different income levels spend proportions of their income? I mean, do the rich, you know, do people above $500,000 a year spend significant amounts on things that are not reachable by the rest of us or something like that? That'd be interesting.
the rich are the country.
The question that I think is for me, I mean, just to go back to that is the ability of us to project what an alternative future would look like.
Yeah,
I think that's the biggest limitation that I think students have, and generally we have. The youth agenda for representation that I put out, I have students read the 1966 Black Panther Party, What Do We Want? Mm-hmm. What Do We Know? Which everybody's online, everything's online. And we look at that, and you cross out 1996, and you put 2006, and it's the same program. But it's this idea of visioning. What do we want? What do we need? In a democratic society, what is our vision of what kind of society we want? And that's something that I think is missing oftentimes in terms of the critique of capitalism. What society do we want to create? What would that look like? What I put out as a program is this notion of the commons, and mm-hmm. if we reclaim the commons, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, you know, it can turn to that or the commons. If everybody has affordable housing, truly affordable housing, public transport, free higher education, and healthcare, right? Then we don't have to work as hard. The capitalist has to pay us more, right? The whole economy shifts. So it's like and that's what the GI Bill did, which was the greatest entitlement program ever that created the biggest white middle class in the history of the people of the world, was the GI Bill, right? It was an entitlement program that extended the commons to everybody, to whites, not black folks who passed over to them. But so that's what I put out there. It's like housing cooperatives in urban communities, kind of taking back that. And that's what a DIY sustainable, the discourses around sustainability, the DIY economy to some extent. So it's like, what's beyond a market economy, where that's not the basis for how we see ourselves and our work in our communities.
My last instruction was to get you out of here before the session's over. These are written out for me, I'm not me. So let me thank the speakers for a really interesting session.